This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Cassie McCullough, and thanks for joining me for Best of the Festivals. Tonight, we're presenting Sexing the Story, a lively discussion about sex and writing from the Quantum Words Festival in Perth. Our host, Natasha Mitchell, the presenter of Radio National's Science Friction program. And just a heads up, as you'd expect, this session veers into areas where you may not want young ears about.
Joining us on the stage here today, three fantastic writers, thinkers, creators, evolutionary biologist Rob Brooks from the University of New South Wales. He's the author of Sex, Genes and Rock and Roll, How Evolution Shaped the Modern World, and most recently, a book called Artificial Intimacy, Virtual Friends, Digital Lovers and Algorithmic Matchmakers. Thanks for being here, Rob. Jennifer Mills is here from South Australia, the author of Airways. Her novel Dyschronia was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Award. Her extraordinary speculative fiction engages with gender and sex and power and bodies. Just absolutely fantastic. Josephine Taylor here in Perth is author of Eye of the Rook, which looks at the way that women's minds and bodies and sexuality have been repressed and controlled and manipulated and misunderstood by, well, society, but also the medical profession. Please give them a warm welcome. We might engage in a little bit of foreplay to get started. So, if we may, you know, sex can be hard and challenging and delightful and delicious and satisfying. And I'm interested in the ways that writing about sex can be satisfying and hard. Jennifer.
I think for me, I actually find it quite difficult to write about sex and for that reason, very interesting to write about sex. And for me, the concerns are very much around character and power and narrative tension and what a scene of intimacy can teach you about what's happening in a story. So I guess I'm always looking at it through that broader lens of kind of cultural power and systems.
The big stuff.
Yeah.
Rob, you write about sex a lot as an evolutionary biologist.
I do. That's kind of what my whole research career has really been about, sex. And sort of the one important question, which is why sex are complicated. And that's something that goes back to the first organisms that ever figured out that there's quite a neat trick you can do of combining your genes with someone else's genes, with another individual's genes. But it also requires a great deal of cooperation because you're only halving the information. You're putting forward half of your information with someone else's information to create new combinations. Ultimate cooperative thing, ultimate creative thing to do, and hugely vulnerable to exploitation and cheating. And so it all begins from there. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about it and writing about it, and I tried for 10 years to write a book about why sex is so complicated. And I realised that I was mostly just mansplaining at some point. And so I wrote a slightly different book that confined my gaze to just a component of why it's so complicated.
But a whole lot of sex is not about combining genes. I mean, an evolutionary biologist's thought on this might be, well, ultimately, is it about combining genes? But really, that's not what's on our mind a lot of the time.
Well, it begins with combining your genes. You know, that the definition of sex really is the combining of the genes part. The intercourse and relationships and intimacy are all devices built around ultimately in the very, very long backstory built around this thing that our genes are quite good at doing. And it's not all necessarily to that end, because we've also invented a number of other uses for it, a number of other functions for it. Yeah, a very functional view. I know it's very dry, but I'm trying to think of a suitable metaphor, but I think I'd just get myself into trouble. But really, there's a whole load of other inventions, social inventions, that proliferate from that beginning place.
See, I want you to get into trouble today. So before I come to Josephine, though, Jennifer, you were just nodding, shaking, grimacing. Why?
I tend to disagree with evolutionary biology about the purposes of sex, mostly as a queer person who's been told they're unnatural for a lot of their life. I just wrote an essay about this, actually, about queer natures and the way that these kind of ideologies of nature seek to sort of control our behaviour as human beings and police us. And I'm sure Rob's well aware of this, but, like, there's many hundreds of species that we've studied that exhibit homosexual behaviour that isn't necessarily for the purposes of social cohesion or other forms of reproduction, but also our ways of reproducing as a society aren't simply sexual genetic either. We reproduce through care, we reproduce through culture, we reproduce through storytelling, we reproduce ourselves. And so we've got lots of different things. And, you know, who's to say that genetics is the most prominent or important one?
Oh, that's so wonderful. Here we are reproducing right now.
Yeah.
It's a positive orgy.
and yet there's conflict. Purely on...
Well, there's sort of a certain pleasure in conflict, I think. Maybe we might talk about that. I mean, you know, maybe it's the ultimate seduction. Josephine Taylor, what about you? What delights you and what's difficult about writing about sex and bodies and sexuality?
Yeah. Well, I guess for me it's what I'm writing about is in Ivorookie's vulvodynia, which is chronic vulvar pain. So it kind of affects reproduction and pleasure and all of the things that we've been talking about, and writing about it is difficult because you're talking about pain in that part of your body. But in Ivorookie, I really wanted to show that the women before they developed vulvodynia were actually quite passionate sexual beings, to sort of undo this notion that that this is a sexual disorder. Because I was really interested in the ways in which we think about sexuality and pain as well.
So Alice and Emily are your two characters in Eye of the Rook, and they are separated in time and place, separated in time by 150 years. But their stories are remarkably—they have powerful resonances with each other, don't they? What's happening in their bodies? Mm. And this is intensely personal for you too, because this also happened in your body.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is based on sort of research since 2003, which was an investigative memoir and a PhD, and then I used that as source material for Eye of a Rook. And yes, what's going on in their bodies is that they are both in relationships. They're both, like me, heterosexual, cisgender, so I kind of drew on my own experience for that. But I should note that this pain can be felt by anyone, you know, any biology or gender or anything. It doesn't really matter. As pain can be felt even in arms that have been amputated, for instance. Mm-hmm. It can be felt anywhere. So pain is kind of wild like that. Mm-hmm. So these women are in very satisfying kinds of relationships, and then they develop this pain out of the blue. And
A shocking pain. An all-consuming pain.
Yeah, yeah. And what was interesting for me about that, writing that, was that at one point the pain's so bad, and this was my experience too, I think at one point I'm writing, it's hard to tell, I say, inside, outside, mind, body, brain, because it's actually really hard to tell where the pain is. It's whether it's actually in you or out of you. And I actually really related to both of your books in that way, that kind of uncoupling of pain and sexuality and desire from the kind of body parts we usually assign them to.
Mm. Yeah. But what's very interesting for this conversation is the way in which the medical profession essentially blame the women for being hypersexual, oversexual, excessively sexual, that somehow they've brought the pain onto themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's two things. Like the hysteria, so I did a lot of research into the history of hysteria. So there were kind of two things. It's like the woman is either not having sex, she's frigid, she's autonomous, she's sexually autonomous outside of a marriage, or she's overly sexual. So the idea is basically that we need to contain the woman in a heterosexual marriage, having babies, and then everything is fine.
No self-pleasuring, no masturbation.
No, exactly.
None
it's
of
all
that.
About the penis and the and you know, an orgasm and having babies, basically. So it's very much sort of feeding into a society, you know, a patriarchal kind of society. And the ways in which the sexuality is seen is very, very bonded, very bounded, and when you don't fit into that, I mean, Alice, for instance, in the modern days has a term, the term vulvodynia, eventually, for what she's feeling. But all Emily had was hysteria, which was the catch-all phrase, and a way in which that bodies, any bodies, were viewed based on a male standard of anatomy and pleasure. And then any deviation from that was kind of seen as not normal.
Hurtling into the present day and then probably a little bit into the future, Rob Brooks, in your book, you're exploring what is changing about sexual intimacy as we occupy more and more virtual spaces, virtual intimacy. So what got you interested in this relationship between intimacy and technology and how it's changing?
Well, I guess it began with this wish to find something to focus that question of why is sex and relationships so complicated and such a wellspring of so many diverse types of complication, I guess. And there were a lot of newspaper articles breathlessly declaring that the sex robots are coming. Get it? Okay, they all got the same pun.
That's kind of trivial to you in a way.
The sex robots were, you know, obviously, and they'll continue to be a story because people like to, you know, they like to talk about sex and they like to sort of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And, you know, these are a bit weird, you know, you would be a bit weird to use one of these, etc. And so I thought I'd have a look into that. And it became clear quite quickly that the robots themselves are a very niche topic. My guess is that they may be a plaything for several fairly niche types of sexual kind of fun, but they the underlying artificial intelligence that was being used or at least being touted in those technologies as something that will, you know, make it almost possible to have a relationship with this thing that you own was far more interesting.
You have real concerns about the way in which corporate algorithms are tracking our every click, but also what gives us kicks. So what are your concerns about what's coming or what's already here?
My concerns are really more in the area of virtual friendship. So the narrow, probably slightly functional definition of intimacy that I tend to adopt is the folding of the other into your sense of self. That's sort of how the psychologists like to think about it in the simplest possible way. And, you know, we're very quick to say, well, computers will never be able to do that. That's a very human thing. And no computer will ever be able to do anything like intimacy. And yet at the same time, we are spending a lot of the time, social media in particular are doing, but not just social media, you know, writ large, including things like YouTube, are doing is tapping into the rules, the psychological rules by which we groom each other in order to make those connections, in order to build intimacy by, you know, stepwise kind of self-disclosure to the point where it doesn't matter whether the social media platform is your friend or isn't your friend, you treat it like your friend, and the time you spend being friends with TikTok or with Instagram is time you're not spending, you know, talking to, grooming, becoming closer to the, you know, the humans in your life.
Full fleshly humans in your life.
Yeah.
Taking, because there's only so much attention you can pay to as many things, really, isn't there?
So, and there's only so many hours in the day, and that's true of every technology you might imagine. The specific technologies are relatively irrelevant. They take up your time and they take up your headspace. All primates, all animals are probably, you know, their sociality is constrained by how much headspace they have for remembering who owes what to whom, whose connections are whose, etc. And that space in our heads is also being used up. And so slowly our social lives are becoming more impoverished.
Impoverished. So that's your ultimate concern. Because there are great benefits for our sex lives and for intimacy of living and occupying virtual spaces.
Oh,
it's allowed people to
benefits.
Find their tribes. It's allowed them to transcend all the expectations and binaries that have been imposed on us around sexuality.
Yes. And not only are you able to find your tribe, but your tribe is able to find you. And the better algorithms get at helping people to find out more about who they are in any dimension, you know, that's a huge benefit. I'm certainly not a techno pessimist. I don't think that, you know, we're all going to hell in a handbasket. I think that there's some incredibly clever things being invented. I think the prospect of virtual sex, whereby you're having, you know, some kind of a cross-continental or just with somebody next door, some form of intimacy, you know, it does take away from that, you know, person-on-person bodies kind of thing. But it's also, you know, the casualization of sex can get turned up right up to 11. It can be incredibly safe. You can step out of a scene that you don't like or that just isn't working for you or whatever and you can match with people who are a good match to you from anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's got many benefits, doesn't it? I mean, for a start, you don't have to deal with anyone's arms and legs and where to put things and, oh, my God, all that stuff. It's virtual, it's clean, it's tidy.
You don't even have to have two arms, two legs or, you know, a particular configuration of genitals necessarily. This is virtual reality types of setups in which you might drop into a scene with virtual or sort of simulated other humans.
Genuinely liberating.
Yeah. Or you yourself might drop in as someone other than who you are physically.
This is Best of the Festivals on Radio National Summer, and we're listening to Sexing the Story, a session from the 2022 Quantum Words Writers Festival, and it's about how to best write about sex. Joining RN's Natasha Mitchell are authors Jennifer Mills and Josephine Taylor, plus evolutionary biologist Rob Brooks.
Jennifer, does it sound genuinely liberating to you?
Yeah, to some degree, it's very exciting, the technological possibilities of being able to escape the physical form and also your location in space, because we are socially very limited by the people that are around us. No offence, everyone.
But
I think it's very interesting that we look at the way that technology, we're using technology to police each other's identities and behaviours and sexualities, but actually we've always done that work of policing each other's identities and sexualities and behaviours. We've outsourced it to other institutions like the Catholic Church or school environments, for example, can be great places for this kind of serious social education in what's okay and what's not. And that can be very positive when you're teaching kids proper things about consent and ethics, and very dangerous when you're not. So I think, you know, being able to outsource some of that mental load to technology is actually quite useful, and maybe it will free up some of that space for other social paradigms and other ways of thinking about how we live and work together. But the idea of escaping the physical body was something that I think really underpinned the writing of The Airways, my most recent book. So it sort of revolves around two main characters. One is a guy named Adam, and the other is a person named Yun, who is non-binary, and they're murdered on the first page of the book. It's not a spoiler. And they become something else, another kind of being that is not beholden to the body in the same way. So they still require bodies to live, but they are able to inhabit other bodies very briefly at first. And for me, it was a way of sort of writing about queer survival in the world. It was kind of a fantasy of being able to escape your physical form. But it was also a way to talk about this kind of relationship between the self and the body and intimacy and power and the gaze and how we sort of construct each other and the power dynamics of desire and things like that were very central.
Well, tell us about writing Yun and what you were expressing there, that Yun occupies, kind of moves as a ghost through different living bodies and kind of morphs into their shape and their form and then out again. What was that about for you?
Yeah, well, part of it was a very, very horror kind of idea, like ghosts, haunting, love it all the way. But also this very kind of, I guess, Freudian idea of the uncanniness of the body and the self and the way that we kind of absorb other people's identities into our own with intimate relationships. And, you know, Freud talks about haunting as the way that grief kind of becomes part of the grief, the person that you're grieving becomes a part of you. And I think we've all sort of experienced some version of that. So I was very interested in all of those dynamics, but there was also just this pure queer fantasy of being able to escape your physical form. Like, I was very excited about the idea of what that would make possible. It's something that I noticed after I was writing the book. I noticed how this kind of fantasy of disembodiment is very present in a lot of queer literature and science fiction and queer music as well. So the trans artist Sophie has a song, Immaterial Girl, which is a total like fantasy of being able to transcend the body. What's the other one? Oh, yeah, June Jones from Melbourne. She
musician.
Has a lyric that is like, why can't I just be wind, Wi-Fi or sound, that I've always really related to.
I love,
you know,
that.
I've always had the kind of relationship with my body where I'm just like, well, why can't I just be uploaded to the cloud, you know? Like, I'm going to be the first person who does that. And my partner's like, no way, don't do it.
Why is that feeling a good one? Why is it a liberating one?
I think it's partly because of the presence of all of this kind of cultural policing that we live with, and you don't sort of realise how much work and pressure it is to conform or hide within these kind of dynamics. And they're things that might feel very natural to cisgendered heterosexuals who are told that they're, you know, the things that align with what feels natural to them are natural. And so, yes, sex is reproductive, marriage is normal. And so when you sort of not, when you don't fit easily into those structures, then those structures become very visible and interesting very quickly.
Before I come back to Rob and Josephine, Adam is essentially a sexual predator in The Airways, your book. He watches Yun, he fetishises women's underwear. He doesn't have any kind of, it doesn't seem to me that he has any kind of authentic relationship with women and non-binary people. What was it like writing into Adam?
I think I complained about halfway through the book on Twitter that, like, I was stuck with this quite helpless dickhead, and I was like, is this what it's like to have a boyfriend, you guys? But yeah, he was really annoying me. But I found his annoyingness quite interesting as well. And I kind of found it a little cathartic to write about this kind of failing upward masculinity of, you know, everyone around him enables him to be who he is. He's not doing it by himself. Nobody holds him accountable for his behaviour.
Well, he doesn't even hold himself accountable.
No.
He's in total denial. I'm a good man. I've done nothing wrong.
Absolutely.
I've done nothing wrong. He excuses it because he's had a difficult childhood where his father died and his mother didn't really facilitate his grief. And there's all the other reasons for why he's being a sexual predator.
Yeah, he has a lot of excuses. But I was also very careful to not be too judgmental of him as well. And I did have quite a lot of empathy for him. I didn't want to write a perpetrator victim story because that wasn't interesting to me. So Adam and Yun haunt each other. They're in a sort of, I guess, a twin orbit in a way.
Josephine, let's re-enter the body. What was Dr. Baker doing to women's bodies? He's a character in your book, but he's a real person in history too. What did he do to women's bodies?
Yeah, really terrible things. So his name was Isaac Baker Brown and he was a surgeon in Victorian London. He started using experimental kinds of procedures on women. So he saw if a woman presented with any kind of problems, they would be pretty well immediately categorised as hysteria. And he saw hysteria as a downward sort of tiered disintegration where the ultimate end point was death. That was kind of, if you didn't interrupt this kind of progression. So he actually was performing clitoridectomies to stop this progression, because the idea was, and it wasn't an uncommon idea at the time, that it was self-pleasure. So he talked about peripheral irritation of the nerve, which was basically masturbation. So in order to, so the self-pleasuring was overexciting the nerve, and so we had to get rid of the exciting cause and then restrain the woman afterwards, sometimes with, what's it called?
Straitjacket.
To prevent her from starting again and getting the whole process going again. So, as you can imagine, I was horrified when I found this book and read about all these, because with each case, there's case after case after case, and you don't really hear the women at all. I think at one point the woman sort of, we have her reported, you know, that you will unsex me or that whatever it might be, or that I lost my baby, you know, kind of trying to say, look, you know, I'm kind of unhinged by grief or whatever it might be. But in each case, the woman was cured. And usually the thing would be like she would be fat and having babies and in every respect a good wife kind of thing, and that would be the cure. But you could see that it could be quite easily the case that in each case, I mean, that kind of level of pain and suffering that really would you be saying, well, no, actually, I'm still kind of having, you know, terrible thoughts or I'm melancholic or whatever. If you've just had a procedure like that done, you're going to say, yeah, everything's fine, you know, please send me home, I will have babies, whatever. Yeah, so I was fascinated by his research, particularly when I found, I was telling you about a copy of his book that I found that had a handwritten dedication. But I wanted to bring him into the book, but I didn't want to make him a central character because I thought, no, this is, you know, he had a lot of power. He did have a massive fall from grace.
And that's interesting, isn't it? So yeah. he was celebrated and...
He was celebrated and feted, but not for a massive amount of time. I think the surgeons, in a way, quite liked surgeons being bold and audacious, but he got a little bit too bold and audacious. And he also self-advertised and promoted himself. And in that kind of context, the medical system there was very much into protecting the delicate sensibility of women, you know. And so he was kind of really pushing against the boundaries of a very patriarchal kind of structure, a very paternalistic structure, which is, you know, we women are precious and so on, but we need to protect them from themselves kind of thing. And so we don't really want to give them this dirty kind of information and it's not good for them and so on. And he was being too open and overt. I think he was a farmer's son as well, perhaps that kind of played into it. So he had a brief sort of meteoric kind of rise and then he had a very swift fall. He was also operating on what were called lunatics at the time. He kind of did a whole stack of things that weren't right, and he was called out in a terrible meeting that was reproduced in its entirety. And really, from that point on, he just, everything fell away from him, and he became virtually a pauper. And it's been speculated that he actually had neurosyphilis. I don't know whether that's the case, but, you know, if that affected the brain or who knows.
But his legacy lives on, and this is what you explore in your character, Alice. You know, she's encountering the same sort of judgment from doctors and gynecologists about why she's experiencing this pain and all sorts of commentary about her sex life. And so But it's interesting, in your book, she is quite liberated and empowered by understanding this history. She finds solace in it in a way, and I wonder whether you did the same.
Yeah, so I guess, well, I was trying to do with having these two interweaving threads and including the letters of Emily as well, that to show what had changed and what hadn't changed. and we've become more, we're able to articulate, we're able to talk about sex and vulvas and all sorts now. But there's still those kind of judgments. She's still encountering those judgments. She joins a support group where women are encountering these kinds of dismissive attitudes of get a hobby, have a holiday, drink to relax before, whatever it might be.
She just needs a good root.
She just needs a good, that's right, that exactly, was one of them. And these are actually drawn from real life scenarios. I'm not making these up. I've had contact with a lot of people.
I believe you.
Because I know you've had talked with women with vulvodynia too. So I know that this is what we encounter. She kind of tracks a similar journey to what I did. So again, I draw on my own experience. So in her research and writing, she's not offered a coherent story about her pain. She's not offered something. I mean, vulvodynia just means vulva pain. So it's not really a diagnosis, it's just a descriptor. So really it's up to her to try to make sense of it and to actually do something with it in a narrative sense as well. So she really, she becomes a different person. But what I was trying to show was too, she doesn't become a different person. You know, the relationship that she's in starts struggling, but it's not because of the vulvodynia per se, it's because of who she starts becoming because of what she's forced to become, which is actually, I think that, this whole thing of that when you have that level of suffering and pain, you kind of buckle under. And you might buckle under and re-emerge, or you kind of, in the end, you have to do something with it or stay buckled under. And so she does something with it.
On Radio National Summer, this is Best of the Festivals, and we're listening to Sexing the Story, a discussion about the complexities that surround writing about sex. On stage at the 2022 Quantum Words Writers Festival with RN's Natasha Mitchell are authors Jennifer Mills and Josephine Taylor, along with evolutionary biologist Rob Brooks.
Let's dive further into some of these concerns that you have about, well, what will happen to our relationships in real life? There are some real concerns there. I mean, you describe the incel community, don't you? Just remind people of what those lads are and what consequences their existence is having.
The incel is a portmanteau of involuntary and celibate, and it wasn't always just a heterosexually oriented men thing, but a particularly vocal, active set of subcultures, because they're not really one thing, has taken this over and proliferated on that sort of dark part of the internet called the manosphere. These are usually young men who find that their sex lives are unsatisfactory, and their view is that they will always be unsatisfactory for a number of reasons. One of which is that what we refer to as hypergyny, which is women like and form relationships with and have sex with, successful, attractive men. So you can see that at the very root of their worry is the notion that, women have any agency at all in deciding who they have sex with and have relationships with. And there are some fairly lost people there who are simply need to do a bit of growing up and maybe a bit of getting older, and maybe a bit of, making their bed and all the things that Jordan Peterson tells them to do because they love him. And then there are some deeply misogynist, reactionary, unsympathetic characters there who prescribe things like sexual redistribution, the rolling back of sexual redistribution, basically, the government should give us wives. They should be married to us forever. There should be no-fault divorce, and we can roll back the entire sexual revolution and all of those waves of feminism and all of the good things, or the things that, you or I might agree, and most people in this room might agree were, very good things, but we should roll them back because there's a small subset of men who are very sad about their sex lives. And I'm sorry, I'm being a little bit sarcastic about them because they just deserve it. They are pathetic, but at the same time, they are suffering in their own way.
But they're emblematic in a way. I mean, I bring them up because it's part of a bigger discussion you have about the way in which people are kind of, you know, taking themselves out of in real the kind of real life existence, although virtual life is real life as well these days.
There's a fairly strong case to be made for the fact that technology might solve our incel problem. Now, let me just say, with the incel problem, it's not a new problem. It's not some sort of toxic consequence of late-stage capitalism. It's something that's always been with us. It just so happens that societies that had a surplus of young men without direction who were angry tended to go to war with other societies.
Are you suggesting that we kill a percentage of young men to avoid them becoming sinister, patriarchal conspiracy theorists?
It's just not viable, is it, you know? Napoleon used to boast that he would go through 30,000 men a month. You'd use 30,000 men a month. America, in their Afghanistan campaign, lost something like 2,500 people over 20 years. So it's no longer this, you know, byproduct. But it's certainly one of the other things they do, the Europeans at least would do with this, is send people off on colonial missions, and they'd either flourish or come back or not come back at all. But, you know, other societies have a similar kind of situation. The recruiting method for Boko Haram and for ISIS is exactly the same. You appeal to young men who have no purchase in a mating market that's often biased, stuck against them with things like bride price, where they can never earn enough money to take that place in their society that comes with this. So we've got this surplus of angry young men, and some people say technology will solve the problem.
It partly created the problem, but might solve the problem.
Some people will say pornography's created the problem, but there's a very, very good argument to be made for the fact that pornography, for all of the bad parts of pornography that we talk about quite often, has probably distracted a lot of these young men from their lack of real-world success and is at least keeping them occupied.
I mean, would sex bots fix the problem or would it concentrate, exacerbate the problem? Well, because then they really don't know how to relate to real people. They're only relating to robots. And sex is on demand and they can request any kind of sex. There's no consent required. There's no discourse required. There's no relational thing going on. It's just a bot with a hole in it.
It depends on the business model, really, doesn't it? Because if you've got to be rich to afford one of these things, then you've got to get a job, which means that you need to get out of the basement, et cetera, and go and get a job, which would kind of solve the first problem to some extent at least, in that you would go out and meet other people and, you know, start making your way in the world. If the business model was one of sort of where like Facebook is now, where, you know, if you're not the customer, then you're the product. Well, I'm really concerned about that business model. I don't know that it's going to, that sex bots will solve the problem. Maybe virtual reality sex will. Maybe a super kind of porn might do that. But then again, we're going to want, you know, people like us are going to want to regulate what that is. And we're going to want to teach them how to be whatever it is that we want them to be, which sounds good when you start with that, but then you're stuck with policing people and telling them who they are.
Now, time to hear some questions from the audience.
Let's talk about quokka sex. So quokkas are variable about their reproduction based on their environment. They're animals. Humans are animals. I've always had this idea, and I'm curious of what your thoughts about humans now varying our reproduction sex because of us reacting to the environment that we're in now.
Look, I think that human sociality and sexuality is incredibly variable and context specific to broad context situations as well as to individual context situations, and trying to pin us down and trying to say, well, this is right and that's natural and et cetera, is obviously, you know, incredibly limited thing to do. I think anybody with any sort of humility and curiosity about this would rather study it than come out with some kind of, this is going to be a solution or it's not going to be a solution. Mm. I don't know that there are solutions, and if there are, we don't understand them yet.
So I'm going to be going into doing education at university soon, and my minor will be in physical education, and I'm also interested in doing a side bit of health. I would just like to know, maybe not in terms of so much policing, but what you guys would like to see more of taught in schools or in the sexual education
This is such a good question because I remember doing a forum with a bunch of teenagers and who were really empowered around these issues, and they were just shocked that they were still learning kind of the mechanics of sex and nothing really more subtle beyond basic consent conversation, but nothing about pleasure. And these were 15 and 16-year-olds. Nothing about pleasure and satisfaction and, you know, all those questions around sexual agency. So I was fascinated by that. Josephine?
Yeah, I was just going to say that the highest rate of incidence onset in vulvodynia is 18 to 25. And so I think if you don't know, if you're at an age where you're upper secondary school, going beyond that, and you develop that kind of pain and you're in a situation where you're trying to meet people, form intimate relationships, and you have no idea what's wrong with you, and you go to see medical practitioners who don't know what's wrong with you or give you advice that's incorrect or send you to somebody who's dismissive or whatever, obviously that's a terrible, terrible thing. So I would love to see more more broader discussions around the different forms of sexuality and pain and the kinds of things that it's not a personal thing, you know, that it's actually not to do with whoever you're partnering with. It's not their problem. So to take that level, I think that young people who are discovering sexuality already have so much that they have to kind of take on board that they really don't need to have to deal with the feelings of other people, you know, in response to, say, for instance, with vulvodynia, how to deal with that pain.
Jen. I just want to add that I think we start too old and we need to be teaching really young children about gender diversity, autonomy, bodily autonomy, the ethics and boundaries and how to communicate clearly about the body and their desires. And that's like, that is improving, definitely, but I think we still live with this illusion that sexuality starts at puberty. And, you know, because obviously there's a lot of risk around the sexualization of children in society, we need to protect them, but we don't protect them by making them ignorant of the issues.
But also, how do we help young people develop a language around desire? How do we allow them to sort of go, well, what does desire mean and look like, and kind of give words to that? Because that's never talked about in relation to young people because it's taboo.
But that's an important conversation, isn't it? Because then it means that you might actually get something that starts to differentiate what an adult desire is placed upon a child. You know, so when it starts to get taught at an early age, you start to undo some of those kinds of things that are placed upon children as well.
Rob, any thoughts from you?
It would do, to add to those things, one thing that would really help, and I don't know how to do this, is to have people recognise when they're policing other people's sexuality, sexual activity, etc. I mean, I think that in early high school, the stuff that kids say to each other and the ways in which they interact with each other is brutal, having had kids go through that, and to recognise what it is, but to recognise more broadly what its consequences are. And I don't know that even adults, even theorists of this kind of stuff, have good language for that at the moment.
No, the weaponising of sexuality and sex and, you know, in those early years is so cruel. I mean, how do you even find your own skin in all that, I guess? Any final comments or reflections from you?
Just thank you. It's been a really fun conversation. It's been really great to chat with all three of you about these issues. And I don't think anyone's going to solve it all in our lifetimes. You know, this is an endless conversation.
No, as long as we ever exist on this planet, I think we'll be having these conversations. Please thank Jennifer, Rob and Josephine.
We've been listening to a session from the 2022 Quantum Words Writers Festival. On stage with RN's Natasha Mitchell were Jennifer Mills, author of The Airways and Dyschronia, evolutionary biologist Rob Brooks, who wrote Artificial Intimacy, Virtual Friends, Digital Lovers and Algorithmic Matchmakers, and the author of The Eye of a Rook, Josephine Taylor. An edited version of this session was originally on Science Friction, presented by Natasha Mitchell. It's a program all about science and culture, and you can catch it each week on RN or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.